Feminist Magazine. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back again tomorrow at 6 p.m., and I'll be back with you next Wednesday at 6 p.m., and I hope you will join us again. For KPFK, I'm West Siegmiller.
Hi, this is Moby, and if you care about the state of the world, the environment, freeform music, arts and culture, please make a pledge and support KPFK Free Speech Radio.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. Because we want you to know a little bit more about Feminist Magazine, who we are and how we do it, and why you'll want to support feminist radio on the air on KPFK every week. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
When peace comes, they read the Emancipation Law to the colored people. They, the freed slaves, spent that night singing and shouting. They wasn't slaves no more. That's former slave Pierce Harper talking in 1937 and recalling what happened in 1865 when the slaves in Texas learned that they had been freed, emancipated 2.5 years earlier by Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. So certainly the singing and the shouting and the celebrating of those slaves happened quite late.
Juneteenth, also known as Juneteenth Independence Day or Freedom Day, is the oldest known celebration commemorating the end of slavery in the United States. Dating back to 1865, it was on June 19th, Major General Gordon Granger came to Galveston, Texas, to inform a reluctant community that President Abraham Lincoln, 2 years earlier, had abolished slavery in the U.S. and to comply with his directive immediately. I'm Anita Johnson, and this is From Juneteenth to Reparations, the Freedom Promise of Unfinished Resolve on Making Contact. In this show, we'll trace the history of Juneteenth from the late 19th century freedmen colonies and settlement celebrations. Presented by Dr. Shanette Garrett Scott, a historian of gender, race, and capitalism, she shares a history of the African-American narrative that's rarely explored.
The end of the Civil War did not immediately come to Texas. I mean, it was June 2nd, 1865, before the Confederate General Edmund Kirby Smith finally surrendered to Union forces in Galveston. So slaveholders in Texas really refused to acknowledge that the war was over, and they refused to give up their slaves. Now, holding on to such a fantasy, I know you're probably thinking, how could they continue to do this? But it really wasn't as hard as you would think. That's because Texas was really kind of insulated during the Civil War because of the Confederate blockade. There weren't that many battles that happened in Texas. So the Texas was really shielded from the brunt of the Civil War. In fact, slaveholders, especially those in Mississippi and Louisiana, would bring their slaves to Texas to hide them from the oncoming Union lines. So at the end of the Civil War, there were untold, you know, thousands, maybe tens of thousands of slaves that were added to the 180,000 slaves that were already living here in Texas. So Union Brigadier General Gordon Granger, and that's his picture there at that bottom, arrived with about 1,800 Union troops at Galveston in mid-July. Don't really know the exact date, but on June 19th, Granger made news of freedom official. He stepped onto the balcony of Ashton Villa, which was the former headquarters of the Army of the Confederate States of America, and he read General Orders Number 3. And this order informed the slaves that the war was over and that they had been freed by Lincoln with the Emancipation Proclamation 2.5 years earlier. Now, the reactions of these newly emancipated slaves was mixed. I mean, you had some people who stood in utter disbelief. People shouted prayers to God, but most sang and danced right there in the streets. So I want to take a moment really to correct some misconceptions about emancipation. Now, it is true that Texas slaveholders and Confederates had suppressed news of the Emancipation Proclamation that went into effect in 1863. But the truth is really that the Emancipation Proclamation really didn't free that many slaves. It didn't free the vast majority of slaves. First of all, it didn't even apply to the border states, the slaves in the border states that stayed loyal to the Union. And then, of course, the USA could no more dictate, you know, what the Confederate States of America did with its citizens than Jefferson Davis could command Lincoln to leave the, quote, peaceful and contented slaves alone, lest he incite them to a general assassination of their masters, end quote. But more important than all that, the slaves did not wait around for a proclamation or a piece of paper to say that they were free. Between 500,000 to 800,000 of the 3.5 million slaves, they ran away during the Civil War. They freed themselves. They did not need a piece of paper or someone coming to tell them what they had come, what many African Americans have come to know, that this war was a war of freedom and emancipation, that it was about slavery. Now, these runaways, they ran to the north, but many of them ran to the Union lines right there in the South's backyard. And many of them set up camps and they started free communities. And those who didn't run, were already shifting, you know, the power dynamics on the plantations and the farms throughout the South, including Texas. So therefore, Africans were already forging these new visions of freedom and citizenship long before General Gordon stepped onto the balcony of Ashton. Now, I don't want to leave you with the impression that Juneteenth is not important. It is. Because with that announcement, it was only then that Texans were forced to finally acknowledge that African American men, women, and children were now free and that they were no longer property. And the word spread quickly. Some people stayed put, others left immediately. They wanted to get away from their masters. Many wanted to find family members who had been sold away. Some people went north. Some people even left the country. So June 19th became Afro-Texans' new Emancipation Day, or Jubilee Day, as it was often called. Now, the first Jubilee Day celebrations took place, of course, right under that Ashton Villa balcony. The first official celebrations began in 1866. And from the very beginning, the Black Church, which was the most important independent institution in the African American community, was really central to those celebrations. And in the 1860s, at Peyton Colony, which was a freedom colony in Blanco County, the Baptist Church there held a special Juneteenth service. And then the children marched in a circle from the church to the school, to the cemetery, and then back to the church, and kind of a symbolic reuniting of the free living with the deceased and unfree ancestors. They even had fireworks. So they created these by cutting holes in trees, and they filled them with gunpowder and set them on fire. So by 1870, in Texas, there were nearly 50 freedom colonies, or these settlements of emancipated African Americans. And there were hundreds of them, but 50 of them were located near Comanche Crossing in Limestone County. And the largest and most popular Juneteenth celebrations occurred right there. So African Americans also celebrated in communities in Texas City. In Texas cities, and Austin and Houston especially were very popular. They even purchased land to creating these emancipation parks to hold their Jubilee Day celebrations. Now, there are not a lot of scholarly sources on Juneteenth, but a few people who talk about it mention that they start using the term Juneteenth instead of Jubilee Day after 1900. But in my research, I've actually found that it was in the early 1890s, as early as 1891, that African Americans in their communities were calling Jubilee Day Juneteenth. And Juneteenth, of course, it's obvious. It's just June and 19th, where they cut out the 9 and they squeeze the June and the 10th together. So by the early 1900s, Juneteenth celebrations had spread from Texas to southeast Oklahoma, to southwest Arkansas, and parts of Louisiana. And they rivaled Independence Day celebration. So now, to people looking on the outside, they probably saw these people celebrating and eating and playing games, and they thought of them as these kind of just jubilant celebrations that took place on one day a year. But during these celebrations, especially in the 1860s, 1870s, and 1880s, blacks were talking about their political rights. They even had politicians, people running for local governments and state governments, come to the Juneteenth celebrations and picnics and stump to get the African American vote. They encouraged blacks in attendance to register to vote, because freedom included the right to vote. And it was that right was slowly being taken away during the last decades of the 1800s. And of course, it was completely compromised by the early 1900s. Now, Juneteenth can really teach us not just about the past, but it's also important in our more recent history, society and politics and culture. So if we just look at it inside American history, instead of something that happens parallel to or outside of U.S. history, then we get a deeper meaning out of what some would consider a hidden history. For example, in the late 19-teens, to the 1930s, those large-scale, community-wide Juneteenth celebrations actually became less frequent. So people continued to celebrate, you know, in their homes and in their churches and in their communities, but those really big county-wide celebrations, like the ones at Comanche Crossing, really became almost non-existent. And so I had to ask myself, well, you know, why is that? So I thought, you know, about looking at the period, what was going on in America at the time. So by World War I, the late 19-teens, segregation laws firmly in place. There was this tide of nativism that was engulfing the country. And so for anyone who doesn't quite remember what nativism means, that means there was this rejection of outsiders, this fear of foreigners. So I think that combining segregation, racial discrimination with this xenophobia and nativism led many whites and even many blacks, African Americans, to see Juneteenth as un-American. Un-American because it focused on this dark period in American history. It was precisely at the time that the United States was trying to show itself as this global power, you know, on the world stage. And so, ironically, therefore, Juneteenth was considered unpatriotic, that celebrating it showed that you were disloyal to the United States. And that time, not only did it commemorate this really dark period, but those were also some dark days at that time, because this was during the Red Summer, which was a wave of deadly lynchings and race riots that occurred in the United States from 1919 to 1921. But, you know, Juneteenth is a spirit of freedom and it refuses to just die. So there's this renaissance that comes in Juneteenth that occurs shortly before the United States goes to World War II. And the really important catalyst for this renaissance happens right up 75 in Dallas, Texas. So you have Antonio Maceo Smith. He's an educator and he's head of the Dallas Negro Chamber of Commerce. And he's trying to lead efforts to create this commemoration or an exhibit of African-American life and culture for the Texas sesquicentennial in 1936. Well, the state fair organizers refuse. And so Smith does not give up. So he goes over their heads to the federal government and he actually secures a $100,000 grant. And he uses that money to build the Hall of Negro Life on the state fairgrounds. Now, local white leaders protested the construction of the hall, but there was nothing that they could do. It was completed and it was dedicated on Juneteenth, 1936. And so over 46,000 African-Americans streamed into the state fair grounds for the largest Juneteenth celebration ever held up to that time. Now, the hall, unfortunately, was demolished soon after the fair closed, but that spirit, that rekindled spirit, they could not destroy that. And so then it was after 1936 that the Juneteenth celebration was revived in these more public commemorations. That's because African Americans now were emboldened because of their success during the centennial. And also this was in the 40s, you had World War II, and African Americans were fighting for what they called a double victory. So there was a victory over fascism abroad and a victory over racism at home. And so these Juneteenth celebrations in the 40s and the 50s really highlighted this idea, rekindled this idea of equal rights. They would also honor former slaves and African-American veterans. Now, during the civil rights movement that really started to kick off in the mid-1950s through the 1960s, many blacks really were more conscious, you know, about drawing the connections between their present day movement and their ancestors' historical struggles for freedom and for equal rights. So in debate and reactions surrounding the Civil Rights Act, many made the explicit connection between that act and fulfilling the freedoms that were first guaranteed in the Emancipation Proclamation, and that the Juneteenth general orders show this deferred freedom. So President John F. Kennedy mentioned the Emancipation Proclamation in a speech calling for federal civil rights legislation. And after his assassination, LBJ pushed through the bill. And one of his aides told him, quote, "It's equivalent to signing an Emancipation Proclamation," end quote. So the deferred freedom that was celebrated during Juneteenth speaks to this struggle for equality and rights that continued through the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And the activists in the 1960s clearly made those connections to Juneteenth. The organizers of the 1968 Four People's March held a Solidarity Day rally, and they held it on Juneteenth, 1968. And African Americans attended from all over the country. And so after they returned home, they either revived or they initiated Juneteenth celebrations in their hometowns around the United States.
You're listening to From Juneteenth to Reparations, the Freedom Promise of Unfinished Resolve.
You can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. It's easy. If you do that right now, your conscience is clear. You have done it for this fun drive, and then you can go back to listening to the rest of the show. Or you can call 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK. And that is just one example of the kind of story we love to highlight. So Feminist Magazine brings you voices like that, and also feminist artists and creatives, plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action, you know, grassroots action, and make a difference yourself. That is what we actually mean when we say at the top of our show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And you can support us to keep us doing that right now. You can just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. You can give $10, $25, $50, $100, or become a sustaining member. We want to be a sustainable radio station. And so if you just give us your credit card, we do a monthly payment. You choose how much. And then it's a sustainable way to keep bringing you these stories. Site is kpfk.org, and there's a donate button. You are listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK 90.7 FM and kpfk.org.
Hi, I'm Annie Tip, a Cal State LA journalism student and a producer and host with KPFK's Cal State LA Community NewsHour. So far, I've produced and hosted, and it has given me a better understanding of how to speak for broadcasting, and it has allowed me to work alongside my professors and classmates as well. The show has helped me develop and improve on my audio engineering skills, and it allowed me to find my passion for radio and broadcasting. I've gained real-world experience with hosting and producing on KPFK's Community NewsHour, and I was very happy to be able to hear my own voice and work on the radio. And for that, I'm really thankful for the opportunity.
KPFK, your community radio station.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next.
Hey, oh, hey, yeah. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
We'll expand our conversation of Juneteenth to include a case for reparations. Next, we'll hear from attorney Fania Davis as she explores reasons for the U.S. government to reckon with and compensate for centuries of stolen labor and legal oppression. As the 2020 U.S. presidential campaign cycle ramps up, Democratic presidential candidate hopefuls vying for their party's nomination are taking positions on the issue of reparations for slavery, elevating the discussion to the mainstream. Fania Davis was one among a panel of scholar activists who described some of the experiences under which Black people lived during and after slavery, and recounted examples of what reparations could look like. Making Contact producer Monica Lopez brings us these excerpts from a panel recorded this spring at Mills College in Oakland, California.
Fania Davis worked for 30 years as a civil rights trial lawyer, and later in the field of restorative justice with youth in the schools and in the juvenile justice system.
That work arose from my origin story, having been born in Birmingham, Alabama, which we called Bombingham, Alabama, during the height of segregation and the height of the movement resisting it. I was born on Dynamite Hill. That was my neighborhood. Homes were bombed in our neighborhood because Black families moved in, pushing the color line. So that experience growing up in apartheid and, you know, going to stores where we couldn't be served and being called derogatory names and being insulted every day and being exposed every day to the pervasive social messaging that Black people were subhuman, in addition to the racial terror is what set me on this path of being, in many ways, a warrior for social justice. And in later life, after so much fighting and anger, both as a trial lawyer and as a street activist, I had some experiences which made clear to me that I needed to bring healing energies into my life, and that was my attraction to restorative justice, which is based on indigenous healing and peacemaking.
Slavery existed as an institution in the United States for nearly 2.5 centuries. When former slaves were finally emancipated, Jim Crow laws ensured that the segregation and unequal treatment of African Americans would continue for about another century until 1964 and the passage of the Civil Rights Act. Over the years, there have been symbolic gestures and some tangible offers of redress. In 2008, the U.S. Congress offered an apology to African Americans for slavery and Jim Crow.
First, I just want to say this is 2019. It's exactly 400 years. The first African captives were kidnapped and brought to this land. And I just want to speak that, name that 400 years. And the reparations movement, quiet as it's kept, has been going on for about that long. And finally gaining a little traction after 400, after all those years. So the apology in 2008, important. However, in the restorative justice movement, we say it's not just about saying sorry, it's about doing sorry. I remember one of the elevator women during the Kavanaugh hearings said that she had serious concerns about Kavanaugh as a Supreme Court justice, because for her, justice was recognizing that pain had been caused, taking responsibility for the pain that was caused, and number three, working to repair the harm, the pain that was caused. The first actual reparation effort that's recorded was by an African-American woman who was freed after her slave master left the country. He was Isaac Royall, and in fact, he was one of the main founders or patrons of Harvard University. Isaac Royall was a royalist, so when the war was lost and the Americans won and the British lost, he fled to the Caribbean. And one of his slaves, Belinda, proffered a petition claiming that she was entitled to reparation for the many, many years of labor, and she won. And then after that, there were Quakers who insisted that the Quakers could not own slaves, and they needed to free them if they did own them and give them reparations. And then you had General Sherman after 1865, after Emancipation Proclamation. There was a field order number 15 that said that the government would give a newly freed slaves 40 acres and then later a mule. And some African Americans did actually receive that, but very, very short-lived. As soon as Andrew Johnson came, who succeeded President Lincoln, the special order was repealed. And one I forgot that just occurred. Georgetown students voted that they would pay reparations to the 272 descendants of the slaves who were sold to keep Georgetown from going bankrupt. There was a commission that was formed to study Georgetown's complicity with slavery. That was a couple of years ago. They identified, as a result of this research, 272 descendants. And now they're in the process of talking to these descendants to discuss what reparations might look like. And they've already started to offer legacy admissions to descendants of the 272. I think some descendants want a Truth and Reconciliation fund, and that they have not agreed to that as yet. But the students, you know, just did a really, this is historic what they've done. And, you know, there's the Chicago Torture Reparations Fund, where the government, I don't know exactly how much, but more than $5 million, I think considerably more, I'm not sure, to survivors of black families who were tortured and brutalized and terrorized by police. And that reparations fund involves creating a trauma center and offering trauma services, job training, income supports, housing. And then in Charlottesville, there's also a reparations fund. It's about $4 million, I believe. But even though it's small, it offers some glimpse into what a macro scale reparations might look like. There are income supports or checks, you know, like Jews get checks. But it goes beyond checks. That's not nearly individual compensation is important. But supports for housing and education and parks and scholarships and supports for youth are part of that Charlottesville Reparations Fund.
There are many ways in which reparations may be made. And Germany, says Fania Davis, offers examples of how that country has made reparations for the Holocaust.
Germany, as I said, started with checks. Now, Germany has done an incredible work, especially in the education area. They have completely transformed the curricula to require that the Holocaust be taught not just in history or just in sociology classes, but in music classes, in art classes, in every single course, every child in a public school in Germany must learn about the Holocaust. And every year, teachers are given continuing education so they can teach more effectively. I think we can definitely learn a lot about that. I saw a U.S. News and World Report front page that said that only 8% of high school students in a study knew that slavery had anything to do with the Civil War. So the first thing that needs to be done in any campaign, a strategy for reparations, is truth-telling. Like I mentioned earlier, universities are starting to do that. And many white individuals, growing numbers of white individuals, are starting to do that. That's really, really important. And then, you know, taking responsibility, saying sorry and doing sorry. Fundamentally, any reparations movement must be anti-capitalist, because that's where all of these pervasive human rights violations, the genocide, the slavery, and all of the afterlives of slavery, it's the colonization and conquest of peoples of color in Asia, Africa, Latin America. That was all ushered in by racial capitalism. And we say racial capitalism. There's no such thing as just plain capitalism. It's racial capitalism. Because there would be no capitalism without Mississippi. Manchester, yes, England, but, you know, there would be no capitalism were it not for cotton. And were it not for all of the conquests in third world countries. And so we've got to figure out how to completely transform our society, our government, our schools, our economic system. That needs to be a bottom-up, participatory, grassroots process. But one of the things that we really can't do, in my view, is to have a process that's dominated by experts, and that's a top-down process. The last thing I'll say on this question is we need a healing component. The trauma resulting from genocide and land theft and forced assimilation and the Indian boarding school, leasing and school-to-prison pipeline and the immigration oppression that we're witnessing. And it has really hurt us, all of us.
That was Fania Davis, social justice activist, civil rights trial attorney, and restorative justice practitioner, speaking as part of a panel on reparations at Mills College in Oakland, California. Special thanks to KLW for permission to use the recording of Fania Davis. She spoke on a panel about the multicultural dimensions of reparations. Again, you've been listening to From Juneteenth to Reparations, the Freedom Promise of Unfinished Resolve. Thank you for listening.
You can support KPFK and our show today. Just go to the kpfk.org website and just click the donate button. It's that easy. And that was the kind of story we love to highlight. Not just stories of what's going wrong. We like to bring you stories of activists telling you how they're standing up to injustice, and feminist artists and creatives who are making films and writing books about ways to make change in the world, different ways to see the world. Plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action and make a difference yourself. So that's what we actually mean when we say at the top of the show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist, but also engage. And you can support us to keep doing that right now. You just go to kpfk.org, the website, and you click the donate button. And this is Feminist Magazine on KPFK 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. And I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And we're proud to be on KPFK, along with a whole other host of varied voices from the community, but also varied perspectives, perspectives that you're not going to hear anywhere else on the radio dial, not in any of the kind of canned and already digested versions of news that you'll get anywhere else. But right here on KPFK, we're bringing you stories from our activism, from our lives, and from folks that we're excited to share with you. You can support KPFK and our show today. Just go to the kpfk.org website and just click the donate button. It's that easy.
I'm Nita Valens, and this is a Fund Drive moment. I'm here to remind you that our listeners are the most reliable source of income for KPFK. Yes, that's you, making up over 90% of our annual budget. With your gift right now, you could move us closer to our goals and help us shorten on-air fundraising. Please call 818-985-5735 or pledge online at kpfk.org. Thank you.
Amid national outrage over the police killing of George Floyd in May of 2020 and other police shootings of black people, the movement to defund the police became a rallying cry to reimagine our approach to public safety.
This is a revolutionary moment, and I'm really happy as a veteran to be able to witness it, to be able to recognize that the work that we may have done 50 years ago really has made a difference. And I think that we're seeing developments and processes that we could never have really imagined. Years ago, when we were talking about, you know, how to popularize abolition, it would have been impossible to predict that at one point there would be huge, massive demonstrations at a time of a global pandemic. They went out and protested against racism at their own peril, using slogans like defund the police.
That's Angela Y. Davis. She's a political activist, author, professor emerita at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and she co-founded Critical Resistance, an organization working to abolish the prison industrial complex. For more than 50 years, Davis has advocated for the abolition of prisons, casting the issue in human rights terms and urging a broader vision of justice. Davis's work is grounded in a feminist framework and global transnational lens. On December 1st, 2020, in conjunction with Haymarket Books and Study and Struggle, Davis spoke about the need to create a worldwide movement to shift away from harsh punitive policies and the manufactured need for police and prisons. The talk also included other scholars, such as Lorja Garcia Pena, an activist and the co-founder of Freedom University, Georgia. Medin Palos, a filmmaker, researcher, and an activist working for LGBTQ and citizenship rights in Italy. And Letty Volpe, a law professor at UC Berkeley. The conversation was moderated by Makani Thimba, a chief strategist at Higher Ground Change Strategies based in Jackson, Mississippi. Again, Angela Davis.
I've been doing work that might be described as abolitionist since the 1970s. The Attica Uprising took place in 1971 when I myself was in jail. And I remember the call for abolition that came from the Attica brothers struck me as explaining so much of what I had not been able to explain or understand. The historical process, for example, the connection between the putative abolition of slavery and what needed to happen with respect to prisons. I think I've always been interested in processes that emphasize and popularize historical consciousness. I studied French literature, and I studied philosophy, but always in historical contexts. And I say that because I think historical consciousness is what we lack in this country. There are white people who still think that because they or their immediate families were not directly involved in slavery, that they're completely exonerated, that they bear no responsibility. They have no idea what historical responsibility means. Capitalism, especially capitalist ideology in its neoliberal form, benefits from this historical amnesia, because the temporality that capitalism urges is a perpetual present. It's one of the reasons we find ourselves trying to address problems now that should have been addressed over 150 years ago. And it's also, it seems to me, why we end up calling for reforms over and over and over and over again. If one looks at the history of incarceration and the history of policing, one discovers that there have been calls for reforms throughout the histories of these institutions. As a matter of fact, the calls for reforms have constituted a central element of the history of these institutions, and as such, have become the glue that has held these institutions together. And of course, even as these reforms have been instituted, both incarceration and policing have only grown more racist, more repressive, more violent. And this is why I was so struck by the call for abolition, the radical alternative. And when I say radical, the etymological meaning of radical is root. And so abolition allows us to get at the root of the problem. It enables us to escape from being trapped by the same framework and the same footprint. So we don't look at policing and incarceration as discrete institutions that must perpetually remain at the core of our attempts to make human community. So I see abolition as a revolutionary perspective. It asks us to understand and resist not only the particular institution we're concerned with, and of course we've talked about police and we've talked about prisons and educational institutions and university, but it asks us to address all of the conditions and forces that enable the continued existence of the institution. So we won't simply add the adjective humane to the name of an institution that is so deeply flawed, so structurally racist, so profoundly influenced by heteropatriarchal ideologies, that we would have to say, well, we know policing is racist, so let's struggle for a more humane racist policing. We know incarceration is inherently class biased, inherently violent, so let's struggle for a more humane class bias, a more humane violence, a more humane wall, a more humane ICE. And so I've come to the conclusion, both as a result of my scholarly work and my activist work, is that we have to enlarge our analytical framework if we want to avoid being trapped on this treadmill of reform. We have to ask questions about connections and relations, relationalities. In other words, we have to do a feminist analysis. We don't ask the question, what can we do to make an institution that has already demonstrated that it can never fundamentally change? How do we make that institution change? But rather we ask, what are the contextual conditions and surrounding social forces that need to shift in order to ensure that we don't need to rely on these institutions in order to survive and in order to flourish. Therefore, we need schools, not jails, but we don't need schools that try to become jails, which is what we have now. And I would say that this is what we have come to call an intersectional approach. And the part played by feminism, anti-racist, anti-capitalist feminism, is not only to ensure that we keep gender within our frame, but it is to ensure that our analysis is not lazy, that we don't shy away from complexity, that we realize that abolition involves both the negative process of overturning and disestablishing, but also, and more importantly, the reconstructive process of creating something new, not just one new thing, but addressing all of the enabling conditions. So I guess I would conclude by saying that, and I did a webinar with Lenny not too long ago on abolition feminism and the meaning of abolition feminism. I would end by saying that abolition needs feminism. It needs anti-racist, anti-capitalist feminism. But feminism needs abolition. Otherwise it becomes the kind of carceral feminism that Lenny was talking about. And I think that abolition has to be placed within an internationalist framework. Let's not only think about the U.S., but let's think about Brazil. Let's think about Palestine. Let's think about Europe. Let's think about Australia. And with that, I think I'll conclude.
Moderator Makani Themba.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you, everyone. It's good to hear from each of you. I have a couple little questions. They're going to be a little different, I think, because from listening to everyone. And I've been reflecting a lot on the fact that this is the 65th anniversary of the Bandung Conference. And for many folks, a turning point in understanding of themselves as international, not the birth, but certainly an important milestone in how many of us thought about how our movements were connected, all these kinds of things. And I also think about this question, and this makes me think about something you brought up, Lorja, in terms of these communities of rebellion, this idea of sort of debordering, right, and resisting. And when I was listening to Angela and actually all of you talk about the ways in which we continue to replicate these oppressive models, even sometimes in the ways we organize, is people trying to translate, like, what does it mean to organize from this place of freedom, from liberation? And so I was curious if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about how you see these communities of rebellion, like, what does that look like? And that sort of process of education or maybe uneducating, diseducating to disrupt all that? Like, what does that look like?
Lourdes Garcia-Pena.
You know, I think for me, I think the work is exactly how Angela was describing it. It has to do with building and with being able to and willing and having both the fortitude, the amount of hoping that needs to happen. And when I say hoping, I'm not talking about you sitting with a rosary and praying, but rather believing that the kind of work that you are putting energy into is going to actually create effective changes, because otherwise, what is the point of doing the work we're doing? But I think for me, when it comes to learning, when it comes to creating communities that are hopeful, that are feminist interventions into the world that we are choosing to create, not the one that we are inheriting it, it has everything to do with community and with transnational community, with sitting with each other together. I think for those of us who are scholars and who are trained as scholars, we've been trained that to believe that, especially if you're a woman of color, that there can only be one of us, that there can only be one of us in the room, that there can only be one of us in the classroom, that there can only be one of us teaching this particular subject. And that is how we've been socialized, and that is how the institutions operate, and this is how they maintain this exclusion, this violence, because it's both oppressive and isolating. And I think in the classroom with students, that is replicated in these ideas of, we found something in the archive, and therefore you own it, and now you own history, and that legitimates you. And I think that the work that I'm hoping to do, the work that I'm trying to do with my students and with my colleagues, is to think about learning as communal. Think about learning as a process that can only happen if we all together put a little bit and think together. And it's so, we all know this. We all know that we learn from each other. This is why we're here as a group, and this is not an individual lecture, because we know that we learn from each other and we learn from bouncing off ideas. But somehow, our educational systems do not reward that. We reward the individual paper. We reward the individual book. We reward the individual intervention and the words and the whatnot. And I think that one of the main goals that we should have as educators is to not only abolish that idea, but invite collaborations and invite unlikely collaborations of multiple people, because this is how we learn, but this is also how we can grow. These are very practical ways in which we can build this kind of transnational communities that we're striving to build. We can't build those by staying in our own corners. We have to talk to each other. We have to find that space. And that space needs to also be practical. We have to think about things like childcare and caring for the elderly and so on. If we don't have those resources, if we don't have that as part of what we're doing, then we cannot move forward.
The conversation we've been listening to was originally hosted by Haymarket Books and Study and Struggle. The talk explored how to build a global movement for abolition and the types of shared knowledge, strategies, and organizing in an internationalist movement to abolish police and prisons.
So you can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click that donate button, or call 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK. So during this fund drive, and we're limiting the number of interruptions and preemptions so that your favorite programs like this one can keep going on the air, providing you with the information and the news that you can only get on KPFK. So please show your support for the station and for this approach. We want you to kind of vote with your actions and say, yeah, we want to keep having programming. But the way we'll know that is if you support us. We want to keep doing this approach to fundraising, but you can do your part by pledging online, kpfk.org, or call 818-985-5735. If it's been a while since you last donated, even if you've never donated before, if you've been listening but you've never donated before, there's no time like the present.
Don't procrastinate. We want to go forward. So do it now and make a generous donation, as generous as you can, to keep KPFK part of your daily life, to keep Feminist Magazine part of your weekly life. We're in challenging times, and your contribution really is vitally important. So we thank you for your help and support. We thank you on behalf of all of the other listeners and all of us right here at KPFK. We work as a collective of diverse voices and contributors. And like you heard in that last segment, that whole thing of diverse voices is not just a set of differences, but a way to kind of come together, collaborate, and make something bigger and better. And that's what we do on our show, Feminist Magazine, and that's what KPFK does as well. So it means that there's a bunch of viewpoints giving you, our listeners, all kinds of perspectives, stories, and guests every week. And it goes across generations too. We mentor new contributors here on Feminist Magazine. We love doing that. We love teaching radio skills like interviewing, engineering, and editing to young college students, to grassroots feminists from different communities across the city. And all of us who are part of the show are activists in different communities around LA, but we give our time and sweat to FemMag because we believe in radio. Go to kpfk.org and click donate if you want this to keep happening, to keep going, and these kinds of stories, this kind of work, to be there every week for you. We're inviting you to give $100 or be a sustainer, and that is amazing to keep KPFK sustainable. You give us your credit card, you say how much you want to donate every month, and then it's automatically taken out. You don't have to worry about it. We have a sustainable base that we can work from, that we can build from. And all through this past lockdown and pandemic, we have all kept going remotely for you. So show us a little love, won't you? Go to kpfk.org and click that donate button right now to support the show. And speaking of love, we love getting feedback from listeners about the show. We've been getting great feedback on our programming during this fund drive. Reminded her how she got involved in activism and then moved into climate justice. It's part of an ongoing wave of being part of making change, and we're happy to support that. So we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Thanks to all our guests and contributors today. And now is your last chance to support KPFK in this hour, in the Feminist Magazine hour. So if you like what you just heard on Feminist Magazine, please support us to keep doing that. Go to kpfk.org and click the donate button or call 818-985-5735. And thank you.
KPFK is on the move. By mid-March, we'll be operating out of new studios that we're building this week at a new temporary location in Glendale, California. This is Michael Novick, Interim General Manager at KPFK. Coming up on Leap Day, Thursday, February 29th at 3 p.m., I'll be on the air with a management report to you on the state of the station. I'll be taking your calls, suggestions, and comments live on the air. That's this Thursday, February 29th at 3 p.m. And don't forget to donate now at kpfk.org or by calling us at 818-985-5735. Press option 2 for the pledge line. Make sure you remember, because we'll be having elections again later this year for delegates. I'll be talking more about that again this Thursday, February 29th at 3 p.m. live here on KPFK.
Support comes from UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting Alfredo Rodriguez on Friday, March 22nd at the UCLA Nimoy Theater. Schooled in the classical conservatories of Havana and discovered at the 2006 Montreux Jazz Festival by Quincy Jones, Cuban-born pianist Alfredo Rodriguez's artistry is informed as much by Bach and Stravinsky as his Cuban and jazz roots. More information